Good morning. Can we start the meeting? It's about that. Morning once again. The chairperson is not in today. And in terms of rule 131 of the NA rules, in the absence of the chairperson, then the committee has to elect one of its members as acting chairperson. So I am going to open the floor for nomination. Can I please put up? the name of Honorable Chana Majake, Dylan Majake. Any further nominations?
Now
all agree. All agree. The Majak. Okay, no comment. Thank you, Chairman.
Can I take the opportunity of greeting you all and again to convey the apology from the chairperson of the committee, Honorable Matola Motsega. Today we're going to be engaging on the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill 215. We'll have a briefing from the Department of Justice. And I take the opportunity to request the department to introduce the bill.
Thanks. Not the department, it's the Deputy Minister. And as you know, there's a difference, and that's also why I'm here, because the bills basically come from the executive, not from the department, come from Cabinet. So, as you know, I'm trying to attend all the first meetings to specifically make that link. So that it's not just officials who you think may have, for one or other reason, come up with ideas. It's actually a bill introduced by the Minister of Justice after having been approved by Cabinet. But having said that, I mean, look...
Thank you for the correction. As Deputy Minister Jeffries, can we have the bill from the executive introduced?
Thanks. Okay. Well, it's been introduced. It was a while ago, but just as far as the briefing, it would be the officials from the department, Mr. Bassett, who I think you know, and Ms. Byatt, who I'm not sure they're going to be doing the presentation. I think the main thing I wanted to say was that a judicial matters bill, just because I think it's the first judicial matters bill that this committee has dealt with, and also for, with the media still here, anyway, basically, a judicial matters bill, you'll have one at least every year. Sometimes you might have two. They're called judicial matters bills because they are amending a large number of pieces of legislation, small bits. So this one is, for example, I think I counted 14 pieces of legislation that it's being amended, that are being amended. The other feature of a judicial matters is that generally the amendments are not meant to be controversial. They're meant to be sort of small things that are not particularly controversial. And I think having said that, I think I'll then hand over to Mr. Bassett to take you through the briefing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Minister. Deputy Minister said, we've got Ms. Fatima Bayat here. It's her first time in the committee, and she's going to assist me with this presentation. I'm going to kick off with the first few slides, and I'm going to ask Ms. Bayat to take over from me. As our Deputy Minister said, this is a relatively straightforward bill, I'd like to think. It's typical in nature, and it amends a number of Acts of Parliament are administered by the Justice Portfolio. Chair, two documents were circulated. I hope honourable members have received them. The one is the PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to talk to now, and the other one is a thickish document, but what we've done is the sections that are being amended in this bill, we've duplicated the actual provisions of each act that's being amended, so that's on see the amendments in their context. So the second document is really for the benefit of members so that they can have a look and see that provision being amended as it stands at the moment. Without further ado, I'm going to launch into the presentation itself, which is on the screen. And the First Amendment, Clause 1 of the Bill, amends Section 9 of the Magistrates' Courts Act. Now, Section 9 of this Act deals with the appointment of judicial officers, and it's called the magistrates. And at the moment, Section 9.5 provides for the appointment of acting magistrates. And Section 9.5 says that an acting magistrate may not be appointed for longer than 3 months. And Clause 1 amends this provision to allow the minister to appoint a person to act as a magistrate for a maximum period of 12 months. So the period is being extended from 3 to 12 months. And magistrates or people don't have to be appointed as acting magistrates for the full 12 months. It can be for a period up to 12 months. And why is this amendment necessary? It's necessary to address practical problems. The Judicial Matters Amendment is generally a bill that addresses challenges that have been experienced in practice, and this is a prime example of that. The Magistrates Commission has difficulty in filling a vacant post of a magistrate within the 3 months, which is currently the position. And the 12-month period is more in line with the appointment process. And we think that it also assists in attracting persons who are prepared to act as magistrates, since they will invariably be appointed to act for a longer period at a stretch than is the case now. So that's Clause 1 of the bill.
Chairperson, I just think it may be useful, given that each clause is quite different, because that's the only amendment to Magistrates Courts Act. I'd want to suggest that if there's maybe questions on this one, that you take them now rather than doing it all at the end. And this clause, I must say, I have a particular interest in, which I can explain why if people want.
The suggestion is accepted. I think it makes sense. Can we engage clause by clause? For now, maybe the suggestion is that we get comments and questions around this one. Honorable Swart, Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Mumla.
Well, basically, I have a delegated function to appoint the acting magistrates, and it is the way the process works. I mean, in terms of the Act, the minister appoints after consulting the head of court concerned. In practice, the head of court, the chief magistrates or the regional court presidents, will send names or applications for continued acting appointment. And the chief magistrates will generally get it from senior magistrates, heads of court, whatever the case may be. But it's just quite an onerous process all round, and enormous amounts of paper being generated. What's happening in practice is that people are acting. In terms of the law, they can only act for 3 months at a time. This increases this to 12 months at a time. But people are acting for quite extensive periods. It's something that I'm personally not happy with, whereby, so you've got people acting for 10 years, some of them, and that particularly I'm not happy with, because those people, as far as I can see, are almost becoming permanent. And an acting magistrate is the same as a full-time magistrate. So there's no difference, if a judgment is given by an acting magistrate, there's no difference between the status of that judgment or that order and an acting magistrate, or permanent magistrate rather. So there is an issue of trying, I've been raising, and you may have picked it up in different sections, I've been raising with the chief magistrate, the heads of court, that I'm not comfortable appointing people for a continuous period of more than 2 years, 2 years continuously.
Obviously, there can be special circumstances they can motivate, so a small rural town may have difficulty finding somebody to act as a magistrate. But in the cities, really, the thing should be rotated. But the bottom line is the 3 months is an enormous amount of paperwork for particularly the heads of court, you know, the other aspect is that, for example, when a magistrate is permanently appointed, they're then put on probation, and they have a probation period of, I can't remember how long it is, but it's a number of months. During that period, they still have to be reappointed every 3 months as an acting magistrate. So it basically will make life a lot easier. Obviously, a new person, it's 12 months is a maximum period. A person who's going to act for the first time, I would think, would probably still be appointed for 3 months to see how they go. But after they've looked as though they've there aren't any problems with them, then it probably could go up higher to 12 months. And a probationary magistrate who's been through the whole interview process with the judicial, with the Magistrates Commission, those should definitely be on a 12-monthly basis.
Thank you, Honourable Peyton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minister, the Deputy Minister, needs some answer has already covered me. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Sumblan.
Nothing is good, I'm support it.
Thank you very much. We can get to the next clause.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause, clause 2, repeal section 384 of the Criminal Procedure Act of 1955. That is the Criminal Procedure Act that is the predecessor to the 1977 Act. Now, strangely enough, this 1955 Criminal Procedure Act, there are only two, I think, only two provisions of that remain. And the one is the section 384, and I think the other one is 319. I'm not too sure what that deals with. But section 384 of this act deals with binding over persons to keep the peace. That's the formal name. We often refer to them as peace orders. And this provision was placed on the statute book to deal with disturbances of the peace. It was often used in disputes between family members or disputes between neighbours. Now, this procedure comes from 1955. You can imagine it's fallen into disuse in many parts of the Republic. And it's been taken over by the provisions and remedies that you find in the Protection from Harassment Act and the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act. The 2000 Act, PAPUDA, deals with harassment as a prevention. And I think the Protection from Harassment Act of 2011 deals, among others, with disturbances of the peace and harassment. And that's what peace orders were all about. We consulted with the Magistrates Commission, and most magistrates, or lots of the magistrates, virtually all of them, have commented, said, yes, let's do away with this provision. It's constitutionally suspect as well. It doesn't always give the other side an opportunity to come and present his or her case. So basically, we are repealing this old provision, which really has served its purpose, and we've got legislation which is far more effective and constitutionally sound that can deal with the issues that this old provision deals with.
So can I just add, with a peace order, you approach, well, you get a peace order from the magistrate, I think just sitting in chambers. If the person who you've got the order against breaks the order, they can be arrested by the police and locked up. So as Mr. Bassett has said, the whole issue of the person having the opportunity to have their say, having a return date, the processes in the Protection from Harassment Act are much fairer to everybody concerned. You get the interim order in the Protection from Harassment Act, you have a return date where the person can oppose it if necessary. The problem is that certain areas, a number of parts of the country, they were no longer issuing peace orders, but in some they were still. So there was a case I had to help somebody with at Khayelitsha, where a peace order was issued. It was a neighbor dispute. Peace order was issued. The person the order was issued against was very much in dispute of the facts. The neighbor complained that he'd broken the order and he got arrested. And really, it all seems to be pretty unconstitutional. So if this section goes through, people will largely have to use the Protection from Harassment Act and the orders provided for there. And that process is a lot fairer to everybody concerned.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Can we have comments and questions? Honorable Mikapo. Any further comments and questions? In the absence of any, can we proceed to the next case?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next one, clause 3, we're amending section 1 of the Prescribed Rate of Interest Act, it's the 1975 Act. And at the moment, section 1 of this Act provides that if the debt bears interest and the rate at which the interest is to be calculated is not governed by any law or by any agreement or trade custom or in any other manner, the interest will be calculated at the rate prescribed under subsection 2 by the Minister of Justice after consultation with the Minister of Finance. And this amendment actually originates from a proposal by National Treasury. And National Treasury is saying that the prescribed rate of interest under this Act and the standard interest rate should be similar and based on the same market principles. And what we would find in practice is that the interest rate under this 1975 Act wasn't always in line with the standard interest rate. And National Treasury proposed, therefore, that the interest rate in this Act should be based on the repo rate determined by the South African Reserve Bank plus 350 basis points and should be adjusted whenever the repo rate changes. And that's what Clause 3 does. We object to this proposal by National Treasury, and it will ensure that the prescribed rate is in line with the repo rate determined by the Reserve Bank from time to time and reduce prevailing market conditions. And in terms of this amendment, Minister of Justice will publish the new interest rate by notice in the Gazette whenever there is a change in the prime rate which is announced by the Governor of the Reserve Bank from time to time. I think in a nutshell that's what this amendment is about.
No logistical nightmares around this. Was changed. You had a system that was uniform. Now the suggestion is that you have a system that actually complies with the repo rate at a particular point in time. And I'm just asking, there won't be any logistical nightmare.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it will address a whole lot of issues that have been prevalent up to now where the rate under this, interest rate under this Act is not in sync with the repo rate. And now it is going to bring it in line. And if you look at the amendment, it requires the Minister of Justice, whenever the purchase rate is adjusted by the South African Reserve Bank, the Minister of Justice must publish the amended rate of interest contemplated in paragraph A by notice in the Gazette. So it's going to be constantly looked at. So every time there's a change in the repo rate, the Justice Minister must publish this in a public way in the Gazette, so it's going to be publicly available, and as I say, in the past, the difference between the rate interest rate under this Act and repo rate have been at odds, and you are addressing that. And I recall when this bill was made available for public comments, it received very positive feedback from people in the industry.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Honorable Mulana and Honorable Kfalt, do you have your hand up?
Yeah, I just want to wonder what is the criteria for using 350 basis points? Could have been 50, could have been 30, why 350?
Respond,
I'm not too sure of the exact details. I can try and get that. This was a proposal that we sent from National Treasury, but I can undertake to come back and just respond to that when you meet again.
Honourable Sir,
that was what I wanted to ask, but do we know what the present rate of interest is? Maybe it can come back to us as well on that, because then it will give an idea as to how far it is apart from the inflation rate.
Do we have any further comments and questions? In the absence of any, we'll proceed to the next clause.
Ms. Bayat says the current rate is 9%, but we will get back to the committee members on the other matter.
Can you get to the next clause, please? Put on your mic, Honourable Swart.
The present repo rate we're talking is 9.75 or something, or 9.25.
Yeah, look, I think the intention, I think obviously they must come back with the information, but the intention is basically if you're owed money and you get a court order that you're owed that money, a fair way of calculating the interest if the person doesn't pay. I mean, obviously it would be great if the person who owes you the money, who the court has ordered owes you the money, must pay. But if they don't and it takes them a year, that you are able to recover a fair interest level. I think the officials need to come back. So I understand at the moment from if the repo rate currently is 5.75, so plus 350, it would be 8 point something. Currently it's 9. So it's not sort of too bad at the moment, but that's because the repo rate is down. I mean, when the repo rate and the interest rates were a lot higher, I think people were not getting what they were entitled to in waiting for a debt to be paid. So this is basically linking that to the interest rates. That if you owe money and the interest rates are high, you're losing out by not getting a higher rate of interest, which you will get if this amendment goes through. And why, on what basis they picked an additional 3-point repo plus 3.5%, I'm not sure. It may well link to the rates the banks offer, because presumably if you are owed R1,000 and the interest, and you can invest that money in the bank and you can invest it at an interest rate of whatever, I don't know, or you need to borrow that money, it would link to what you would commercially. So I suspect it's that, but I think the officials should come back with the detail as to particularly why 3.5 to 350 basis points.
Yes, that is my fear, that if I borrow money from a person who is not authorized to do so, like he's not a bank or he's not a creditor, then there is a certain amount now today, is it 15% or something per year? 15 there, I'm not sure whether he might fall.
The interest rate was initially 15.5%.
Correct.
And then it has been reduced to December from the 1st of August 2014 to 9%.
To 9%. So what I'm trying to say is that this, how is this amendment going to affect the fairness of the 9%, if you see my point? That's the question. When you compare these two, and what is the criteria of using that, and how is it going to affect it? That's my question.
Thank you, Honorable Kumblan. I think we've addressed the questions and comments. The agreement is that you should please try and look into it for us so that we apply a principle of fairness, especially when it comes to the basis points, because when it comes to repo rate, it's always clear as to how it's determined by the MPC. Thank you. Can we get to the next one?
Thank you, Chair. The next provision is clause 4 of the bill, and this amends the Magistrates Act of 1993. It amends section 13 of the Magistrates Act. And section 13 of this Act deals with the vacation of office by magistrates. This is quite a technical amendment. Section 15.5A2 of this Act provides that the minister may, at the request of the magistrate, allow the magistrate to vacate office for any reason which the minister deems appropriate or sufficient. And in terms of section 15.5C2, if the magistrate is allowed to vacate his or her office for a reason which the minister deems sufficient, that magistrate is then deemed or regarded to have been retired in accordance with section 16.4 of the Public Service Act. That's what section 15 says. And if that magistrate is deemed to have been retired, that magistrate is entitled to pension benefits that he or she would be entitled to under the Pensions Act applicable to magistrates. And this is regardless of the fact whether the magistrate has reached the age of retirement or not. This amendment is really intended to deal with the situation when a magistrate is appointed as a judge, and that is happening, that this sort of magistrates were in the past not appointed as judges, and there are times now when magistrates are appointed as judges. And before I return to the PowerPoint presentation, I should just mention that a judge, when you're appointed as a judge, you are a judge for life. And I think honourable members know that judges continue to receive, even after they've been discharged from active service, once they're retired, in other words, they continue to receive a salary of a judge for life. Judges don't contribute to a pension fund, but they have the benefit of a salary for life because they are judges for life. To return to the PowerPoint presentation, if you've got a magistrate who is appointed as a judge and that magistrate has not reached the age of retirement, that magistrate, in terms of the existing law which I've just explained, is regarded as having retired and must receive the pension benefits as if he or she had reached retirement age. And this is where a complication comes in, because section 17.4 of the Government Employees Pension Law provides that if any action taken by the employer or if any legislation adopted by Parliament places any additional financial obligation on the government pension fund, the government shall pay to the fund an amount which is required to meet such obligations. So the law already says if government allows something like this to happen and a magistrate is deemed to have reached retirement age and is entitled to full pension benefits, government must make good the extra money that is going to be paid out of the pension fund. That's what the pension fund law says. And as I've already pointed out, former magistrate who's appointed as a judge will receive a salary for life in terms of the Judge's Remuneration and Conditions of Employment Act. Now, there are magistrates that are being appointed as judges, as I've said, and I've got maybe some particulars here where a magistrate was 57 years old, and government, I understand, had to pay in 400,000 to the fund. This amendment is intended to address that situation, to prevent unintended and undue financial implications that may be imposed on the state in the event of a magistrate being appointed as a judge and has not reached the age of retirement, as provided for the government's appointed pension law. So that's what this amendment is about. And clause 4, you will see, inserts two new subsections in section 13, section 5A and 5B. And to summarize what they provide as follows, that a magistrate who is allowed to vacate his or her office as magistrate when he or she is appointed as judge is entitled to the payment of his or her accumulated actuarial interest in the government employee's pension fund, as well as the payment of all accumulated leave. This magistrate is given two options, namely to have the payments transferred into a designated preservation fund, or pension fund, until the magistrate attains the age of 65, which is generally the retirement age, or to have the payments made directly to him or her. And the second option has tax implications. So, in terms of the new proposed subsection 5, when a magistrate is appointed to the judge, office of judge, he or she shall be entitled to the payment of his or her actuarial interest in defining the rules issued in terms of the government's employee pension fund, as on the date of appointment of the judge, and the payment of all accumulated leave on the date of appointment of the judge. Then the new 5B goes on to say, a magistrate referred in subsection 5, and this is where the two options come in, may request the government employee's pension fund to transfer full actuarial interest from the said fund to a designated preservation fund, where the monies remain until the former magistrate attains the age of 65, whereafter he or she can buy a monthly pension and take out an annuity with a further option to withdraw one-third of the accrued amount of cash. Or the magistrate may, second option, request the government employee's pension fund to pay the full actuarial interest to him or her and not transfer the monies to a preservation fund. Preservation fund and a pension fund. Now, Chair, these two options are really the same as the options that are available to public servants when they retire. You can get the money paid directly to you and not to go into a pension fund that has tax implications, or you can say transfer it into a pension fund that I nominate and I will be entitled to that money when I turn 65. So those are the two options that are available to judges, to magistrates to find themselves in this position when they become judges. They are treated in the same way basically as public servants who decide to use public service. But these judges do get a salary for life. And this amendment avoids the situation where government has to pay out huge amounts of money into the pension fund as a result of the situation. That's a long explanation, but that's really what this amendment is about. It has the backing of the Chief Justice and the Judiciary and
thanks, Mr. Bassett. It actually sounds like something that's really going to help save a lot of money for government. On the other hand, there's this new law that has been introduced around pensions. Does it continue to allow lump sums to be paid out 100%?
I think that's in the offing. I don't think it's law yet, but I understand National Treasury is coming up with a bill that's going to require everybody that wants to leave their employment to have their pension monies put into a pension fund for their own good and the good of everybody else. So
Thank you, Mr. Bassett. Can you have, do you want to wait for more input?
No, look, in spite of Mr. Bassett saying all stakeholders are happy, I wouldn't be surprised if you do get some opposition from magistrates, because the people who are benefiting, the people who are benefiting are the magistrates who become judges. In terms of this state, and I think it's an unfair benefit where obviously the money they've contributed to their pension fund, they must get back. But this issue of the state having to contribute when the state is already going to then give them effectively a pension, a salary for life. So you might have some opposition there, but I would urge that you stand firm on the matter, because it's really an unfair, it's the people leaving for other reasons, not because they're going to then get a nice job or a job where they get a pension for life, basically.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Honourable Mpumla.
Yes, just for this question, specifically the directors that people want to go about the charges, it doesn't affect any other it's normal.
This is an amendment to the Magistrates Act, and as such, it will only affect magistrates.
No, I understand. But what I'm trying to say is that only those who become judges, that's the best. Otherwise, other magistrates, there's nothing that.
These amendments will only affect magistrates who become judges. If you have a look at the new proposed subsection 5, when a magistrate is appointed to the office of the judge.
This is why I'm asking the board. That is, that you put in a magistrate who's going to be a judge. All I was saying is that there is no problem if the magistrate is not, for any other reason, that's not going to be a judge. Is that what you suggest?
The question maybe is, what if the magistrate wants to go into join some other establishment? He wants to go into academia, for example.
Chair, I think the answer lies, the minister has, as I indicated right at the beginning, may at the request of a magistrate allow the magistrate to vacate office for any reason which the minister deems sufficient.
Yeah, but this only applies as in terms of the section to magistrates who are going to become judges. It doesn't apply to anybody else. So if the magistrate is on sick leave, wants to go into private practice, wants to become an academic, the section doesn't apply. So it's specifically for, as you would see, it's specifically for when a magistrate is appointed to the office of a judge, what they're entitled to. Only those categories.
Any further questions, comments? Thank you. Can you get to the next close, please?
Thank you, Chair, and I'm going to ask Ms. Bayat to take over from here. And we will go to clause 15, 17, and 18 of the bill. They deal with the same thing, and I'm going to ask the Fatima to continue.
Thank you, Lord. Chair, clause 5 seeks to amend section 36 of the Judicial Service Commission Act of 1994 by making the Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice the accounting officer for purposes of the Judicial Service Commission in place of the Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. In similar vein, clauses 17 and 18 seek to amend the South African Judicial Education Institute Act 2008 by making the Office of the Chief Justice responsible for the South African Judicial Education Institute and also making Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice the accounting officer of the South African Judicial Education Institute in place of the Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. The purpose or the reason behind these amendments is to enhance the independence of the Office of the Chief Justice.
in this respect, see clause 5 of the bill, which amends section 36 of the Judicial Service Commission Act, clause 17, which amends section 1 of the South African Judicial Education Institute Act, and clause 18, which amends section 13 of the South African Judicial Education Institute Act.
Okay, maybe just briefly, because as you know, the separate department, the Office of the Chief Justice, has been established, and currently functions relating to the High Courts relate to that office, and then the bills here, the Judicial Services Commission, the South African Judicial Education Institute. Those acts refer to the Director General of Justice. But because those are now under the Office of the Chief Justice, the correct person is the Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice, and it's simply a name swap to provide for that.
Any comments or questions? It seems like it's just straightforward.
Yeah, that's very straightforward.
The transfer of powers to the Office of the Chief Justice. Thank you very much. Can we go to the next class? Chair, the next clause is clause 6, which seeks to insert a new section 4A in the Special Investigation Units and Special Tribunals Act of 1996. Section 4 of the Act requires the Special Investigation Unit, from time to time, as directed by the President, to report on progress made in its investigations, to submit final reports at the conclusion of any investigation to the President, and at least twice a year to submit a report to Parliament on its investigations, its activities, composition, and expenditure. The proposed amendment to Clause 6 seeks to strengthen these reporting responsibilities by requiring the head of the SIU to report to the President and the Justice Minister on a quarterly basis on progress made in its investigations and matters brought before the SIU or any court. The proposed new section also gives the discretion to the head of the SIU, whenever requested by certain institutions, persons and functionaries, to report on an investigation and matters brought before the special tribunal concerned or before any court of law. A discretion is deemed necessary as it may in certain cases or circumstances not be appropriate or advisable to report on an investigation or a matter. Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Honorable Mkhumbulana?
No, it's a question of clarification, I think. Honorable Deputy Minister.
If you can just explain. I don't understand about the question of the discretion. I understand the other part. And head of the SIU may be contacted by anybody. Can I get clarity on that?
The last sentence. Discussion is deemed necessary.
Yeah, on the discretion of the head of the...
Can you have that clarified, please?
So you might end up in a situation where a specific institution is being investigated and that institution is trying to get information that might not be appropriate to divulge at that stage. And I think it's really there to... it's only inappropriate where the head of the SIU thinks that it's no problem to make it, but you might have somebody in the institution that's being investigated trying to get information that shouldn't be given out to people.
Honorable Mayla.
Thanks, Chair. On the discretion, just to check, is discretion also applicable to the president?
Chair, the discretion your clause says must on a quarterly basis report to the president.
Are we clarified? Thank you.
I mean, just look, this one got the most attention when the bill was tabled, because the SIU is quite is an important body. And I mean, I would have phrased it as this, that the clause is sort of two sections. Must report to the president on the head must report on a quarterly basis to the president and the Minister of Justice on the progress made in respect of an investigation. And then the second part is may, when requested by the Premier, the executive authority in terms of the PFMA, etc., the SAPS, the Revenue Service, that's where the discretion is. So remember that the president appoints, it's the president who issues the proclamation for the SIU. So the reporting requirements are mandatory for the president, but it's optional as far as everybody else. And obviously there would have to be a rationality on refusing. There would have to be a basis for refusing. But as Mr. Bassett says, it might be quite sensitive. They may not want to disclose particular information at that particular time. What's the current situation? There's no reporting requirements at all.
There are, in terms of Section 6, the insertion of Section 6 there, I think, in terms of Section 6, functions of the SIU are to investigate, to refer evidence, to perform, and from time to time, as directed by the President, to report on progress made in the investigation matters brought before the SIU. So there is a sort of a loose arrangement from time to time, as directed by the President. This new provision now requires the quarterly report.
The issue around the reporting, it says they must report to the President and the Justice Minister on a quarterly basis. So my question would be, is he going to report to both of them on a quarterly basis? Or to the president separately, or to the minister separately? Because my understanding is that the president appoints the minister to take certain functions on behalf of the president himself. So what would be the kind of a meeting? Would he be reporting to both of them? That waiting, they need some clarification in terms of the kind of reporting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the wording is the head of a special investigating unit must on a quarterly basis report to the President and the Cabinet member responsible for justice. He must report, the way I read this, to both of them on a quarterly basis. So a report must be sent to the President as well as to the Minister of Justice.
And those reports would be basically presumably in writing, so I don't think it would be meetings and things like that. Obviously if the principals want meetings, then they can request that, but it would generally be a written report.
Okay. Can we get to the next clause, please?
Before Ms. Bayat continues, we're going to be dealing with clauses 7 to 12 of the bill. These amendments amend promotion of access to information at the PAYA, promotion of administrative justice at PAJA, and promotion of equality and prevention of unfair discrimination at the PULA. So the amendments that she's going to talk to are really the same in nature, but just amending the three different texts.
Okay.
amendments contained in clauses 7 to 12 have the same aim and are similar in nature. They are also intended to enhance the independence of the Office of the Chief Justice and a part of the Department's initiative to transfer functions relating to the judiciary from the Department to the judiciary where they belong. These amendments relate to the training and designation of magistrates who are required to deal with matters arising from the application of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, that is PAILA, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, PAJA, and the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, known as PAPUDA. These three acts were put on the statute book in 2000, that is before the regional magistrates' courts were given jurisdiction to deal with civil and family-related matters by the Jurisdiction of Regional Courts Amendment Act 2008. At present, these three acts therefore only allow district magistrates' courts to deal with matters arising out of the application. The amendments in the clauses under discussion also extend the application of these acts to regional courts. This is done by amending the definition of court in the three acts to include regional courts, that is in clauses 7, 9, and 11. Consequential amendments in this regard are also found in all these clauses. The motivation for this extension includes the following. Many district court magistrates who received training in the past on the three acts have since been appointed as regional court magistrates. The workload of the High Court will be reduced if jurisdiction is extended to include regional courts, and the extension of jurisdiction will also enhance access to justice and it will be less costly for litigants. All three acts require the Chief Justice, in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission and the Magistrates Commission, to develop the content of training courses. In all three acts, the Chief Justice must, in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission, and the Minister, implement the training courses. In all three acts, the Minister must table a report to Parliament relating to the content and implementation of the training courses. Now, these acts were enacted before the establishment of the South African Judicial Education Institute. The South African Judicial Education Institute Act of 2008 now mandates the Institute to deal with the education of judicial officers. In terms of Section 10.2b, Paragraph 3 of this Act, the Council of the Institute must establish and maintain contact with the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission, heads of court, the organized legal profession, academics, and other individuals and entities with an interest in judicial education. Section 15 of this Act requires the Council to prepare and submit to the Minister an annual report. The annual report must include feedback on the activities undertaken in terms of the Institute's functions set out in the Act. The Minister must table the annual report in Parliament. Now, in terms of Section 7 of the SAJE Act, the Chief Justice is the chairperson of the Council of the Institute, and both the Judicial Service Commission and Magistrates Commission are represented on the Council. Now, this being the case, the question is raised whether the requirements in the three acts, specifically requiring the involvement of the Chief Justice, the Judicial Service Commission, and the Magistrates Commission in the development of the training courses, are really necessary. This boils down to unnecessary administration, and it is proposed that these three acts be amended. In terms of the proposed amendments, Clause 8 amends Section 91A of the PAILA, dealing with the designation and training of magistrates by, firstly, transferring the current responsibilities of the Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development relating to the compiling and keeping a list of trained magistrates for the purposes of PAILA to the Magistrates Commission. Secondly, transferring the responsibility of developing the content of the training courses from the Chief Justice
in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission and the Magistrates Commission to the South African Judicial Education Institute. And three, deleting the requirement that the Minister must table a report in Parliament relating to the contents and implementation of the training courses. Since these issues can now be dealt with in the report, the South African Judicial Education Institute is required to submit to the Minister and Parliament. The proposed amendments are intended to ensure that the structures within the judiciary itself take responsibility for the designation of presiding officers to deal with matters arising out of the application of this Act, and that the South African Judicial Education Institute take responsibility for the training of judicial officers. Clauses 9, 10, 11 and 12 contain similar amendments to those proposed in clauses 7 and 8 in respect of sections 1 and 9A of the PASHA and sections 16 and 31 of PUDA. It should be pointed out that in line with the comments received from the Office of the Chief Justice, Clause 11, which seeks to amend Section 16 of PUDA, provides for two separate lists to be compiled. The Office of the Chief Justice will compile the list for trained judges, and the Magistrates Commission will compile the list of trained magistrates.
That deals with sections, clauses 7 to 12. So there was some of that in that.
Thank you very much. Can I open for questions and comments? I'll recognize the other one from Lynn.
No, I'm not sure if this is the correct time to ask this question. Why are the magistrates not transferred to the officer?
It's not really the right place to ask it, because this is legislation. But no, I'll answer it because I think it's a valid question. But it's just not really appropriate in terms of. So basically, the intention is that ultimately the magistrates' courts would also go over to the Office of the Chief Justice. However, a capacity has to be established in that Office of the Chief Justice. And that capacity is not something that can be created overnight. So the intention is, in the next few years, when that capacity is developed, for the magistrates' court staff to be under the Office of the Chief Justice as well. But we can't do it overnight because of capacity constraints. So currently, basically, the existing setup is that regional offices of the Department of Justice are responsible for the magistrates' courts, the court managers, the area court managers, the regional offices, and then there are provincial offices of the Office of the Chief Justice, there's high courts in each province. I don't think there's a provincial office probably yet in Mpumalanga, I'm not 100% sure. But for example, KZN, the court manager of the High Court is the acting provincial head of the Office of the Chief Justice. But on this amendment, basically, the regional magistrates courts did not do civil work before. They then started civil functions, how many years ago? 2008. So these provisions are basically to give them the responsibility or the option, if people so want, to deal with Paia, Paja and Papuda matters, and the process for ensuring that those magistrates, regional court magistrates who may deal with those matters, are properly trained, and ensuring judicial independence, so it's not the minister who selects which magistrates are going to do it, but the magistrates commission .
So I would say it's fairly straightforward.
Okay, and there's some way that really indicates that then you'll have transfer of developing of the contents for the courses society will be the responsibility of JSC instead of the Office of the Chief Justice. Because then...
No, I think, Chair, when the
this? When the original bills were passed, there was no SAJE. So this is now inserting SAJE as the independent body training judicial officers. So it's providing for SAJE rather than, is it the JSC? And the, yeah.
With JSC.
So it's basically amendments that really are necessary because of, I suppose, developments in infrastructure. So the one being that regional courts now hear civil matters, so why can't they hear Paja and Papuda matters? And then number two, when these three acts were passed, there was no SAJE, it was just Justice College. Now there's an independent SAJE, for those that don't know, is South African Judicial Education Institute. It's the body that trains presiding officers. It's under the Chief Justice in terms of legislation passed by Parliament. So SAJE wasn't there when those acts were passed. It's now putting SAJE in as far as the training of those presiding officers. And basically that's the rule with justice. If it's a magistrate judge who needs to be trained, they go to SAJE. If it's an official, they still go to Justice College.
Any further comments or questions? Can we proceed? The next slide deals with the proposed amendments in clauses 13 and 14. Clauses 13.
To make it just go a bit faster. Those are another substitution for instead of Director General Justice, it's Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice. So they relate to those earlier ones. Faster.
The clause 13 and 14 have been dealt with. Clause 15 proposes amendments to section 65(3) of the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act of 2007, known as the Sexual Offences Act. Section 65 of this Act sets out the responsibilities, the functions and duties of the Intersectoral Committee for the Management of Sexual Offence Matters. This committee consists of the Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development, who is also the chairperson of the committee, the National Commissioner of the South African Police Services, the National Commissioner of Correctional Services, the Director General of the Department of Social Development and Health, and the National Director of the Public Prosecution. This committee is responsible for developing and compiling a draft national policy framework for consideration and adoption by the relevant ministers. Section 65(3) provides that the Justice Minister must, after consultation with the Cabinet members responsible for safety and security, correctional services, social development and health, and the NDPP, submit reports each year to Parliament by each department or institution which is represented on the Intersectoral Committee. Now, Clause 15 amends Section 65(3) by requiring the individual accounting officers, namely the Directors General of Justice and Constitutional Development, Social Development and Health, the National Commissioner of the South African Police Services, the National Commissioner of Correctional Services, and the NDPP, each to include in the annual reports of their respective departments and institutions to Parliament, as referred to in Section 40 of the Public Finance Management Act, a separate chapter setting out that department or institution's activities and role on the implementation of this act. This amendment also addresses an uncertainty when these reports are to the Statistics Department. At present, there are different interpretations when the reports must be submitted. The fact that the inputs must now be included in the annual reports of the departments and institutions means that any uncertainty is in this regard is taken care of. All annual reports must, in terms of Section 40 of the Public Finance Management Act, be submitted to Parliament within 5 months of the end of the financial year, that is August of every year. Because these particular reports should be dealt with collectively or jointly in a relevant parliamentary committee, usually in the Justice Portfolio Committee,
and in order not to interrupt or disturb this important facet of accounting, Clause 15 also requires each accounting officer to account in his or her report in this regard to a committee or committees of Parliament sitting jointly or separately as determined by Parliament. It is important that the Justice Portfolio Committee, which was responsible for the promotion of the Acts in Parliament, is able to retain its oversight function on the implementation of the legislation as a whole, but the amendment does provide flexibility, allowing Parliament to possibly also refer the reports to the line function parliamentary committees should it so wish. To continue, Section 66 of the Sexual Offences Act places an obligation on the Department of Health, the NPA and SAP to develop training manuals. In terms of Section 66(5)(b), the Cabinet members concerned must table a report in Parliament every 12 months relating to the implementation of these training courses. In practice, though, the Department's annual reports already include reports on training. Therefore, to avoid an unproductive duplication of reporting, Clause 16 deletes Section 66(5)(b) and adds a new Section 65(4) in Clause 15 that provides that the annual reports must contain a report on the implementation of training courses.
Deal with the next slide as well, which is up there, because the next slide is the amendments to the Child Justice Act are exactly the same as the amendments to the Sexual Offences Act relating to reporting. So instead of repeating everything again, what we're doing in the Sexual Offences Act in terms of reporting, we're also doing the same corresponding provision in the Child Justice Act.
And Chair, maybe the purpose, I mean, Mr. Lodger, I'm not sure how much everybody's following, but the purpose basically was, it's more procedural. You know, the problem is the Act provides a duty on the Minister of Justice to get the reports from these different departments and then table them in Parliament. So the one component of the amendment is that actually the duty is these are government departments, they must report. Okay, and provided in the annual reports, and then the other is just clarifying when those reports should take place. So it's really, I think one could describe it simply as procedural.
I agree, it's just simple procedure. Just to be sure that those reports are received from all relevant departments, including development of the training manuals by the three establishments. Any comments and questions on this?
No, I don't see, I agree. I think it will give us even less burden as we deal with the main amendment on the legislation that is before us, sexual offences. Because if the burden is with the respective department, then it's better off. The responsibility must not be on one department. We need all of us to this responsibility. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Can you proceed,
Ms. Bayet? I'll just quickly do the Child Justice one because it's quite a lot of words, but it's also not that complicated. Basically, when the Child Justice, as far as getting your record expunged, the current regime is that if you haven't been, Ms. Bayet can go into the details, but if you haven't, if you weren't sent to jail without the option of a fine, and 10 years have elapsed, and it's not like a sexual offence where you've ended up on a register or I think a financial matter, you can get your record expunged after 10 years. With the Child Justice Act, because they were children, when we passed that bill it was 5 years. The problem is that the interpretation from officials, correct me if I'm wrong, was that 5 years has to run from the date the Act came into effect. It couldn't apply retrospectively. Whereas, and this is sort of why I wanted to present as a member, Mr. Swart, I think, is the only one left apart from me who was there. The intention at the time was once your 5 years have passed, you should be able to get that record expunged. But the Act didn't actually make that clear. So this amendment basically provides for that you don't have to wait for 5 years from the date of the that section coming into effect. You actually qualify once 5 years have passed. That's in the case of children. So that didn't come out as clearly as I thought it would, but I hope everybody understands. But for my mind, as a member of that committee that passed the bill, that was always our intention. It's just that we didn't put it clear enough in the Act. I hope that this wife would agree with me.
I think it is desirable that we make it much clearer. I can't remember it specifically, but I'm in agreement with the proposal.
Are we all in agreement? Good. We can proceed.
The next clause
21 of the bill seeks to amend Section 15(1) of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act of 2013. This section deals with protective measures in respect of foreign victims of trafficking. Section 51 provides that the Director General of Home Affairs may issue a foreigner in respect of whom a report has been made to a police official as provided for in Section 19, and B, the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service has, in writing, confirmed to be a person who might be able to assist in a police investigation relating to an offence under Chapter 2, a visitor's visa in terms of Section 11(1)(a) of the Immigration Act to remain in the Republic for a recovery and reflection period not exceeding 3 months, for the purpose of accessing the programs referred to in Section 26 of the Act, with the view to enabling the foreigner to make informed decisions regarding his or her cooperation with law enforcement and prosecuting authorities in the investigation and prosecution of a case of trafficking in persons as referred to in Section 16(1)(b). The Department of Home Affairs, when preparing regulations to be made by the Minister of Home Affairs as required by this Act, raised the question whether this provision is also applicable in the case where a foreign victim of trafficking is in possession of a valid visitor's visa. The amendment therefore intends clarifying this uncertainty by limiting the application of the subsection to cases where the foreign victim of trafficking is not in possession of a valid visitor's visa or if his or her visa is about to expire.
It's really just a technical amendment, Chair, as is the next clause, clause 22. It doesn't change the substance of the Act, and it really is just clause 22 of the law is about to amend section 42 of that Act by adding a new provision that the Minister of Home Affairs must make regulations regarding the manner in which a visitor's visa may be extended or withdrawn. This is really just setting out what is already putting into the regulation clause in 43, what the minister is required to do in terms of section 16(1). So it doesn't change anything. It really is just a technical of adding to the list of regulations that the Minister of Home Affairs is required to regulate.
Okay. And proceed to clause 23, then we can open for questions and comments. Chair, clause 23 merely contains the short title and date of commencement. That concludes.
Can you have questions and comments? Questions of clarity. Bongo?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Honourable Deputy Minister, I see most of the legislation that we're dealing with are generally falling within our ambit as the committee and the agency. But this one still appears it home affairs related and so on. Are we not in any way now acting either beyond our scope in terms of dealing with this person? Or there has been sufficient consultation with the relevant clinics?
Deputy Minister?
I think it's quite turned up, but look, basically...
Mr. Swart, after the Deputy Minister, thanks.
Basically, acts get assigned to different ministers, so the Trafficking Act is assigned to the Minister of Justice, but as with many acts, and particularly with justice ones, they involve a number of departments. So child justice, sexual offences, for example, even other ones involving the police and so on. In this case, my understanding is this is a request from, so we have to amend that act, Home Affairs can't. And this, as I understand it, is a request from Home Affairs to effect this amendment to our act. And they can't amend it because it's assigned to justice, but they've asked justice if it can be amended. I don't know, maybe to preempt, this act is still not in effect. Justice, Mr. Bathurst can correct me because I lose track of things, but the justice regulations were tabled in Parliament, as that was in terms of a requirement in terms of the Act. I think Parliament had a certain, I think when we passed the Act we went for deemed consent. So Parliament could say, had a certain number of days, which I think is has passed to say something. The outstanding regulations are basically social development and home affairs. Social development, the minister has assured me that they will, she will sign before the end of the week. There seems to be some mix up on that side. Then I think they've got to be published as well for comment before they can come into effect. And then the last one that's outstanding is home affairs. This may assist home affairs. Our view from justice was that, look, we need the social development regulations to put the act into effect because social development deals with the definition of a victim of trafficking. So without that, you don't have much left in the act. The home affairs sections we can actually implement later because they relate to foreign victims of trafficking. But it may be, as I said, I think Home Affairs want this amendment to assist them with their regulation-making process to make it easier. But Parliament could also be raising the issue with Home Affairs as to where the regulations are.
Honourable Swart?
Chair, I think it's important for us to realise that the interim provisions in the Sexual Offences Act are applied. So it is obviously that trafficking provisions are still applied whilst we wait for this act to take effect. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Basically, trafficking for sexual purposes and of children in terms of the Children's Act are crimes. The trafficking, this act here, increases different categories, spreads the net a bit wider, and it does also include labour trafficking, which is not provided for. So labour trafficking is the one section that is not currently covered by, is not currently a crime until this Act comes into effect.
I think that's an important point so that we don't have the perception that there isn't legislation dealing with this at the moment. But clearly, we are all asking the question, when will the Act be implemented? And as we know, when we dealt with that, Chair, you'll remember there was a lot of contention from Home Affairs side, and that caused a lot of delays. So I'm pleased that the regulations are almost finalised now for social development and justice, but the concern is that if we now allow Home Affairs to issue more regulations, is this not going to delay the implementation of that Act, or can we go ahead and implement those aspects that we can? Because obviously there are many NGOs that are concerned about when the Act will be, the full prevention and combating of trafficking in prisons Act will be in force. So if we can get that assurance, but just bear in mind the history, Deputy Minister, with Home Affairs having major problems and thankfully, Justice went ahead and said, we're not waiting. We're going ahead with as much as we can. So I think that is my understanding as well.
I mean, as I said, the intention is once the social development regulations have been promulgated, and, well, have been promulgated, then to bring the Act into effect, even if the sections relating to foreign victims of trafficking don't come into effect yet because they need the Home Affairs regulations, but at least domestic trafficking and the criminal penalties and so on come into effect. And I don't know if, I mean, just to alert you, I think the justice regulations, as I said, they're all done. The time period, I think, have they been promulgated yet? Okay. But basically, the justice regulations have been tabled. I think they were referred to the committee in October last year. So your time for comment has expired, but if we're waiting, I suppose we could still look at things, but maybe you should have a look at those regulations.
Sorry, Chief. When do you think, given social development have now also signed off, when do you think you'll be able to implement certain aspects of the Act? Do you have a time frame for that?
Okay, Mr. Bassett tells me, I mean, the Minister told me she would sign before the end of the week. And Mr. Bassett tells me that the Act provides that the draft regulations for social development have to lie in Parliament for 60 days. That's to enable Parliament to comment if it wants to. So it would be, I suppose, in the next 3 months. Unless, of course, you want to amend the Trafficking Act and remove the requirement of the 60 days. That's a joke, sorry.
Okay, we'll stick to the requirement of 60 days. Any further comments?
I just want to make the point that the amendment that we're bringing in this bill in no way affects Home Affairs and Social Development. It's not going to stop what they should be doing in terms of regulations. It's just a technical amendment. They can go ahead and do their regulations and do their directives.
I think the point is noted.
Would it not be helpful for us in our resolution to express something along the lines of delays with Home Affairs regulations that has caused the delay in the implementation of this Act? We could just consider saying something like that, just so that Home Affairs doesn't sit back now and say, well, we now have got to wait until this amendment comes in. We don't want more delays.
Indeed, we're glad to see the Act being implemented as soon as possible. Do we have any further comments, questions? That brings us to the end of the business of the day. We will meet tomorrow in S35 to have public hearings on maintenance bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.